Hi, I'm Lucy.
I'm Georgie.
And I'm Jess.
And we are the Female Athlete Podcast. We're here because we believe the conversation around the female body and how it works needs to be opened up. Discussing topics from puberty to menopause and everything in between, the Female Athlete Podcast aims to inspire confidence and empower through education and conversation. There's no shame or awkwardness here, just honest and open conversations about female health-related topics. In our eyes, anyone who uses their body to move or exercise is an athlete. So join us as we open up the conversation. We'd like to thank our title sponsor for Series 2, Pretty Athletic. Pretty Athletic is a unique skincare brand for active women. Whether you're a runner looking for the best moisturiser, an amazing gel cleanser for pre and post workouts, or a soothing tonic to help combat gym skin, Pretty Athletic are the go-to brand whatever your skincare concerns and needs. And did we mention it's also 95% natural, vegan, and packed with scientifically proven actives?
So I've actually used Pretty Athletic products for some time now, and I got in touch with them, and they were really, really helpful because I'm quite a sweaty runner, and I was getting quite a lot of dry skin, particularly around my chin and sort of my lower cheeks, and I didn't really want that. And obviously kept covering it up with makeup and things, that obviously doesn't help. So I found that the actual sweat-proof hydration gel before and after all of my runs and workouts, gym things, has made such a big difference and really cleared up all the dryness. And I actually really like the shower gel. It's the shower scrub, I think it is. And as I said, I'm a particularly sweaty person, particularly after some gym sessions. So that really makes me feel a lot cleaner and cleansing everything and sort of ready for the next workout.
Head to www.prettyathletic.com to view the amazing range of products available and use discount code FEMALEATHLETEPOD for 20% off.
So for a while on the pod, we have been wanting to speak more about pregnancy. Today, we are delighted to welcome Emma Brockwell and Gráinne Donnelly, the creators of the first guidelines for physios and other healthcare and fitness professionals about postnatal women returning to running. So we're really excited to welcome both of them on to talk to us more, not just about the postnatal return to running, but about pelvic floor health, all things women's health, all aspects of running through pregnancy and running postpartum. So thank you both so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure. Firstly, we would love to hear a bit more about both of you. So have you always wanted to focus on women's health in particular? Or did you sort of see a big need or a big gap out there where more guidance and understanding was needed in this area?
If I go first, I think I came into the world of pelvic health a little bit later than Gráinne. And I guess I became really passionate about it when I fell pregnant with my first baby. I've always been a really keen recreational runner, and I was really unwell during my pregnancy with him, so I couldn't exercise, and returning to running for me was really difficult, I think because of the complications I'd had during my pregnancy, but also because I felt there was a real lack of guidance as to how to return to running. And once I started to explore that more, I realised that pelvic health in general, or women's health in general, was what I considered not a topic at the time that was being explored in amongst healthcare and fitness professionals. And I really just developed a huge passion for it as a result of that. So driven by a personal want to know more, but then an absolute huge need that I saw for all women to know more, and that's really where my story or my journey in pelvic health began.
Mine was slightly different. I got into pelvic health before I even had a family. I never foreseen that I would end up specialising in pelvic health. I think when I came out of university, I thought I was going to be the next sports physiotherapist running onto a field. I probably didn't even know that pelvic health physiotherapy was an area that we could work in. And I ended up getting signposted to a rotation in the maternity hospital in Belfast and tried my best to swap out of it, tried to get any of my peers to swap with me. No one would. And I genuinely thought I was going into that rotation basically wasting 6 months of my experience. And boy, was I wrong. That was the moment that I realized that this area was so interesting and that there was so much that could be done and so much that needed to be done. And I just think that at the minute, it's such an exciting area because there is so much more spotlight on it. And even things like this, where we're having podcasts focusing on topics for pelvic health, 10 years ago, I couldn't have imagined this. So this is just amazing.
For the listeners and for ourselves, can you please tell us and kind of give us a bit more of a broad overview of what pelvic health actually is, what it includes, what it entails? And also, we often hear a lot about pelvic floor and, you know, the need to strengthen that, especially after childbirth. Can you give us a bit of an idea about how important and relevant the pelvic floor is to women?
Yeah, so I mean, pelvic health is basically conditions that can occur as a result of changes to the tissue, the ligaments, the muscles around the pelvic area, the abdominal wall. And we know that often these are related to the pelvic floor muscle, not always, it's not quite as simple as that. But for a lot of women, if we can educate them about strengthening their pelvic floor muscle, which is the big bowl of muscles at the bottom of your pelvis that are designed to stop you leaking urine, stop you having any bowel accidents or bowel incontinence or wind incontinence, they support your pelvic organs, your bladder, your bowel and your uterus. And they're also muscles that help provide increased sexual satisfaction as well. So during sex, they're a really important muscle as well. So I think half of it's about understanding what the pelvic floor does and why it's so important. And just like any muscle, if we don't use it, so if we never ever moved our arm, we'd have a real flabby bicep. And it's the same with your pelvic floor. If you don't use it and exercise it, it's not going to be as strong as if you do exercise it. So it's about encouraging women to exercise their pelvic floor. And like anything, we do know, unfortunately, that if you are overweight, that can certainly have an impact on your pelvic floor because of the increased stress and strain around that area. It's about talking about your bowel health, so making sure or encouraging women to avoid constipation and straining on the toilet, because again, that can really weaken your pelvic floor. And what you drink, what you put into to your system and what you eat is also going to affect your gut and your bladder health, which can have a knock-on effect to some pelvic health symptoms that might occur. So there's some really basic things that you can do or anyone can do to not only prevent pelvic floor symptoms or pelvic health symptoms, but also to reduce pelvic health symptoms without the need of seeing someone like me and Gronya. And for some women, those things are enough to make the changes that are necessary. But for some, that's when they'll need to come over and see someone else like me or Gronya.
For people that aren't aware, why is pelvic health so integral to or linked to pregnancy and childbirth? Because I've been reading articles before talking to you guys, and I personally didn't realise pelvic health had so much to do with childbirth. But then you kind of think about it, it seems quite obvious.
Yeah, so I think the most important thing to highlight is that pelvic health conditions or symptoms can affect a woman at any stage in their lives. And we're seeing more and more research that's showing us that particularly women who haven't had babies and are into their elite sports, gymnasts or trampolinists, are experiencing pelvic health symptoms, predominantly leaking urine. And I'm sure we may come back and touch on that a bit later. But I guess a woman becomes more aware of their pelvic health around pregnancy, and that's simply because we have such dramatic, fast changes occurring to our body. We put on weight, our posture changes, the hormonal influences, they all affect our system, particularly that bowl of muscle and the ligaments and connective tissue around our pelvis. So many changes occur, and we can then see pelvic health conditions occur as a result of those changes. For example, urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, pelvic organ prolapse. What we then have, or what then occurs once we've been pregnant, is childbirth. So even if we've had a cesarean section or a vaginal delivery, those tissues will generally experience an element of damage or injury, if you like, and add that into the weakness that's already occurred around the abdominal and pelvic area. When we then have had baby, we have to consider rehabilitating those tissues so that they can cope with the new demands that motherhood's going to place on them. The biggest problem, I guess, is that we pretty much expect women to just have a baby and carry on with normal activities of daily life with a heavy weight, aka our baby, and we don't really give ourselves time to heal, repair, rest, and rehabilitate. So for a long time, there's been this myth that after 6 weeks of having had a baby, once you've seen your GP, you're pretty much good to go, get back on with life. And if it were just that simple, I mean, wow, that would be amazing. But it's not. We know that tissues take longer to heal than that. And we know that with those added demands, we have to respect a healing and a rehabilitative phase, which I think up until recently, that's not really been acknowledged.
And so how does that, how do you inform women who come to you or who you work with to get back to exercise? And you can't, obviously everyone's different, but are there any timelines or timescales that are common?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the reasons, I suppose, that we came about to do the return to running guidelines. While they're written and focusing on running, that's how we trawled the research and looked at the research, but they're applicable to any forms of exercise, and they very much align with and complement with the chief medical officer's postnatal guidance. But it is an individual case by case, because no two women's journey is the same, and they can enter pregnancy with very different stages of fitness and different baselines for medical for their past medical history. But we really extrapolated the evidence out there, and considering everything that women go through, no matter whether they have a cesarean section delivery or a normal vaginal delivery or an assisted vaginal delivery, we really think that if we consider tissue healing and the demands put on a woman's body after having a baby, roughly in and around the 12-week time frame is ideal to consider a return to impact sport. Now, that doesn't mean you do nothing for 12 weeks. We're really pro keeping women active, getting them fit, getting them strong, and basically getting them fit for purpose, because as mothers, whether we're first-time moms or we have other toddlers, you're busy afterwards and there's pretty physical demands on us in a day-to-day life. So it's all about targeting the key muscle groups and giving people a rehabilitation program, ideally bespoke to them, because no two women will have the same interest. So you can't just prescribe Pilates to everybody, because it may not fit with their interests or bias. And so you need to, one, make exercise enjoyable, because that's the only way you're going to gain compliance. And you also have to, I suppose, target it appropriately, speak to the woman, decide what she wants to do, and make patient-centered goals. What we tried to do with the guidelines was give an idea of a time frame, give examples of different types of exercise, that if someone can't access a professional, that they can take ideas from this themselves and guide their own rehabilitation. But I suppose the main aim of our guidelines was to spark more research, which we're delighted that it seems to have really opened up a lot more research focus on this area. And that's where we're really excited to see what changes come about over the next decade in terms of what we know and understand and how we can better guide women.
So interesting. And as you say, everyone's different. You can't prescribe Pilates for each and every person and be that general. But would you say that, you know, there's different sports and different athletes that you will both work with? And we've recently seen Alex Morgan come back, and she's now going to be playing in the Women's Super League over here, but she's recently had a baby. I'm not sure how long ago.
It was, because I think she came over when it was about 12 weeks. So that must have been about a month ago. So yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So does your advice for team sports or field sports vary with the athletes that you're dealing with? The elite athletes, I should say.
Yeah, so I think pelvic health still needs a lot more consideration in the elite sporting world. I know that there's conversations that are being had, but I still don't think there's huge changes in that arena yet. But there are advances being made. And a good example of that might be, I am currently treating Ebony Uzuro-Brown, who is one of the Team Bath netball players, and I can say that I'm treating her because she's said that on her social media as well. She's a very new mum. I think she's maybe six weeks postnatal. And what I love about Team Bath is that they have embraced hugely the need for us to be considering a woman's pelvic health, but not just considering it. They've actually asked for me to be working alongside her S&C coaches, her physio, and they're really serious about ensuring that she returns back to competitive sport when her body's ready. And I think if those teams are starting to do that, I think that's incredible, because obviously she's an England netball player as well. So hopefully that will start having knock-on effects in the national leagues as well. I don't know anything in particular about Alex's return to sports, but I commend it. I think more and more of us need to see elite athletes returning to sport postnatally, because it's so empowering, and it's what we women should be doing is exercising and doing that really effectively. What I'd love to see is how she returned, and you know, whether they had any pelvic health considerations for her return. It would be great if there was some promotion of that, but I don't know her particular journey. But I do think in the elite world it's coming along, but I'd love for it to be taken a little bit more seriously and be really integrated into every woman's return to any form of sport.
Yeah, so what I think is really interesting when we consider sports and group sports and big organizations is the pressures that are on athletes and new moms. There's pressures on all athletes, and Alicia Montana was one of the people who really raised this topic when she, I suppose, publicly put out the pressures that were on her from her sponsorships, and that she was losing her sponsorships basically if she either wasn't fit or didn't return to performance within a certain time frame. And this is not something that's an isolated issue. When we talk or like put the feelers out, it seems to be quite across the board. And a lot of big organizations and sports groups are basically put standards for women that are the same that are for male bodies, and we know that female bodies are very different to male bodies, and that we have to start to consider them individually. So I like the fact that high profile people are coming forward. I also like the idea that they're getting back and proving that women can get back to performance after having a baby. And even if we think in different sports, even Serena Williams getting back after having her baby. But a lot of them have been very public in vocalizing that they actually experienced issues in terms of pelvic health issues along the way. So that's what we're really passionate about changing. The biggest impact Emma and I have found with the guidelines in terms of when we've been on our going around our tour to present, we seem to present quite a lot in the early days, but it was when we presented at sports conferences, because it was almost like brand new information. There was many, very much a male-dominated audience in most of the sports conferences we went to, who were all either coaches or physios or some sort of professionals involved in the well-being of their athletes. And they just basically looked like they had never heard this information before. We got so many questions afterwards, people coming up saying, jeepers, maybe I should be considering this for the team that I look after. And I'm like, yeah. I think you should.
And I think, you know how they say you can't be what you can't see. I think having more and more people come back from pregnancy, and ideally, like, the more they can share their journey, the better too. I know Kim Clijsters is like currently making her return to tennis, and I think she's had three or four children, which is amazing. And I think the more we can profile that and highlight that and, you know, learn from it too, the better. Like, obviously everyone's different, but still, you know, I think that's amazing and really inspiring. I also just wanted to say that last year, the WNBA announced their maternity leave, which I think is a big movement. Like, I think that's in terms of the pressures around sponsorship, because I think, as you highlighted, Grania, the Alicia Montano story is like, it's horrendous. And you just think that's the last thing that a new like mother needs, that extra pressure, when actually they're trying to look after a child and get used to everything that comes with that, but also then a massive rush to get back to exercising when it's just putting their body at risk, both in the short term and the long term. Like, that is horrendous. And the other thing that I just can totally empathize with is going into a sports science environment and mentioning a subject which is just so not normally talked about. And I think I find that around the menstrual cycle, which, you know, the vast majority of the athletes, and hopefully all of the athletes I'm working with, are regularly experiencing. And then I can imagine coming in and talking about pregnancy, and I like putting myself in your shoes, and even imagining some of the athletes going to the support staff and saying, "Oh, I'm pregnant." Like, I cannot even imagine what that conversation would look like. And I think that's really hard, because particularly, you know, in the way of the world at the moment, up until recently, obviously everything's so fast paced, and you're on this treadmill, and in Olympic sports you're just targeting the next Olympic cycle over and over again. And suddenly you're 30 and you think, oh my gosh, but I want to have children. Like, how do I even go about doing that? And this is just focusing on your like pre and postpartum aspect of like women's health, but obviously there's the whole other general pelvic floor health to discuss. But I feel like you could easily get someone that's got 30, potentially been on the pill for 16 years, and then suddenly thinks, oh my gosh, yeah, I want to consider having a child. Like, how do I even go about helping myself here? And I think that is such a challenge. And I think the more we can normalize this area and provide support for athletes throughout that pathway, the better. And that leads on to my next question. So say an athlete comes to you who's just like in the early days of pregnancy, be it an elite athlete or a recreational athlete, what's the process that you go through throughout? Presumably you work with them throughout the whole period of time, but what does that look like? Obviously it can be very different, I imagine, but generally how would that look?
So someone like Sophie Power, for example, who has done an incredible job of maintaining her fitness and her running throughout her pregnancy, you have to really learn to manage her expectations, but also, you know, from my side of things, consider what's occurring with her pelvic health. And it's about keeping the conversation open and also making sure that women aren't hiding those conditions in a bid to not tell you so that you don't pull them back from their sport. But it's also working with them so that they can try and maintain their fitness for their physical and mental health well-being. So for example, with someone like Sophie, we spoke a lot about perhaps pulling back from the running a little bit and finding lower impact options, which will still allow her to maintain her fitness, but also be of interest to her. So she is a huge lover of the treadmill, of hill walking, and she loves that. She loves the strength and conditioning that she's been doing, and she's been doing an awful lot of that, which I think has actually seen her do really well as a result, if you compare this pregnancy to her other pregnancies. And we have regular, perhaps every 2 or 3 months, we will check on her pelvic health and consider how we adapt if needs be, and also her musculoskeletal health as well. If she's incurring any injuries, we have to adapt. So it's just about keeping the conversation open, making sure that you aren't going to be someone that pulls someone straight off of their exercise, because as an athlete, that's not going to work. That physio athlete relationship will break down. But we do have to think about her long-term, or anyone's long-term pelvic health and musculoskeletal gains postnatally. And there's so much research out there now that's showing, I think, that the stronger you are prenatally and the fitter you are prenatally, the better you will recover postnatally. And we've just done some preliminary studies with Dr. Izzy Moore to find out how or why women return, factors that will return women back to running postnatally. And one of those key factors seems to be that women who run during their pregnancy seem to return to running postnatally. So if we can keep women active and keep women exercising with their pelvic health in mind, then that that can only serve them better in the long term as well.
The only things that we would then have to consider in all that is you're just making sure that we educate to empower them to know when they need to pull back from a more medical pregnancy point of view. So it kind of empowers them and helps them feel more comfortable and safer doing exercise. And I think that's what's important. So if we move away from the elite athletes, one of the biggest barriers to women maintaining exercise during pregnancy is fear and lack of understanding and conflicting messages out there about what they can or can't do. And what we don't want to do is wrap women up and decondition them through their pregnancy. So as Emma says, we know from the research, people are better if they're active during pregnancy, and that makes sense. We think of strength and conditioning, and we think of, well, if you know, if you take a footballer off the field and they stop training for a while, they're going to have a change in their ability to perform. If we take women and take them away from physical activity while they're pregnant, it's going to impact their return afterwards.
Yeah, just for some of the listeners that might not have had children before now and things, I know I definitely haven't, so what are the most like common issues that you get presented with?
I have seen, there's a twofold, I've two journeys to go on this question, because I'm seeing a trend very welcomely. I'm very happy to see a trend where more women are trying to access nearly preventative physiotherapy or just to get checked out to make sure they're doing things right because they don't want to end up with problems. And it's really good. And you think that everyone's starting to know about pelvic health. And because we follow a lot of people on social media who are colleagues or like yourselves who have got a focus on female health and well-being, you can be quite tunnel vision that everybody knows about it until you get a stream of people into your clinic who come maybe 1 year postpartum who have had issues since during their pregnancy and didn't realize that pelvic health physiotherapy was even a thing, or didn't realize that it was okay to get help for these issues. Because say, for example, urinary incontinence, pelvic organ prolapse, even pelvic pain, so ongoing persistent pain down below, people don't realize that these are things you can get help for, and think oftentimes they think that's just a part of the process of having a baby, that that just comes with the territory. So having the likes of your platform to educate your listeners so that people can start to realize that actually, while these issues may be quite prevalent in this population, we do not need to put up with them. There is rehabilitation out there. And if I can give any piece of advice to people, it's to put it in the context of, if we consider any other injury or ailment or big life change in a person's body or sport and life or anything like that, such as a knee injury or getting microscopic knee surgery for an injury, there's prehab, there's the surgery, there's a protocol of recovery, there's follow-up, there's return to play testing. If that doesn't work, you scale it back and you get the back. As Emma said earlier, women have a baby and it's just right, see you later, back to porridge on Monday, get on with it. And I think that needs a change, because if we consider microscopic knee surgery to what women go through either with cesarean section deliveries or vaginal deliveries, come on, like we need to do better. We need to do better to inform, and we need to do better to enable women to access services to help.
Amazing. And I love all of that. I feel like we're all about empowering women with the confidence and understanding about this, and all about all aspects of women's health, in fact. And very much to that point, as you already highlighted, we're seeing, or there is some increasing discussion, or I know in the press earlier this year or last year, there was some discussion about urinary incontinence and fecal incontinence. And obviously that's particularly common postpartum. But I know that it's also very common in, or relatively common in, all women and athletes out there. And I think it is very much a taboo area, and it is something which is real, as I'm sure you know. But what can we do to empower women to know how to reduce risk of this, or to even have the toolbox to help understand why it's happening, and as I said, what they can do about it?
I think it's just about education, really. In an ideal world, and I suspect you would help possibly agree from a hormonal health as well. It's about getting in at an earlier age, I think. So getting into the schools and talking about pelvic health and the realities of pelvic health, you know, that you can have a 15-year-old trampolinist or a 15-year-old gymnast who is leaking urine and is trying their very best, wearing dark leotards and costumes and pads to hide this, but they shouldn't have to hide it. It's a very sadly common symptom, as again all the research is showing. And we not only have to explain that to girls, that these things are common but they're not normal and that they can be treated, but also educate the coaches, teachers, that if girls are having these problems, that we don't just say, well, put a pad in it or just carry on and ignore it. That's not okay, because it's going to make these symptoms worse. So my feeling is we need to get in to women at a younger age and explain just the realities of what can happen. And that, I hope, will empower them to not only address these issues, but also to normalise these issues as well. And again, social media is doing, I think, a good job of that. But I don't know if that's just because my social media bubble seems to be doing a good job of that. Again, I think these podcasts like this are just so empowering and important. But it's also perhaps hearing from you know, the elite athletes at the top that these things are existing, and that, again, they can be managed, and you shouldn't be embarrassed. You shouldn't be ashamed. GPs are there to talk about these things, to discuss them, and then to refer you on to someone like myself or Gronya, who treat, this is all we treat. This is our bread and butter. This is what we want to treat. And the best thing about pelvic health physio is that we can get the majority of women better, or if not a lot better. So it's not the end of your sporting career, or if you're a new mum jumping on the trampoline, it doesn't mean that you're forever going to have to pee when you jump on that trampoline, but it does mean that it does involve some exercise, and it does involve some education about perhaps what you're drinking and how you're managing your lifting techniques and your exercise techniques, and with some time and effort you should hopefully certainly reduce your symptoms, if not get rid of your symptoms. So I think it's about providing the positive stories as well around pelvic health.
I think Emma's hit it on the nail on the head there when she said about preventing, because that's where we want to shift the focus to. For anyone listening who had never heard of pelvic health before, or had heard of it but didn't think it was for them because they haven't had kids or they don't have any symptoms, this is the time when you should really actually find out what pelvic health is and start doing things about it, because you can prevent and limit the impact of any of these issues. We know from the evidence that even people who are pregnant, if you do your pelvic floor exercises or your Kegels or whatever you have heard of them being named as, if you do them, they do actually have a protective element in terms of your likelihood to have stretch urinary incontinence after delivery. How do you do them? That's always the million-dollar question. And it's one that we find that even about 50% of women coming into clinic who tell us they know how to do their pelvic floor exercises, they don't work. Once you examine them, they're not doing the right muscles, or they're not maximizing that pelvic floor contraction to the degree that they should. It's can be really hard for women to know how to do their pelvic floor exercises because you can't see someone recruit their pelvic floor. I always describe it in several different ways, because I think different cues mean different things to different people. So it shouldn't be a one size fits all. So that's why I have a little bit of an issue with just getting that handed an information sheet on pelvic floor exercises, because it's only really going to relate to a certain number of women. But one way of thinking about doing your pelvic floor is to imagine you didn't want to pass wind. So we can all relate to that idea of having wind coming. We don't want to pass it. What do you do? Now, it doesn't work for everyone, because some women clench their bum cheeks for dear life when you tell them to do that cue. And it's not our bum cheeks that we're trying to strengthen here. You'll get a nice toned bum if you do that, but you shouldn't know someone's doing their pelvic floor. So if I ask a woman to do a pelvic floor exercise and she's either moving up and down or moving on the spot standing, she's likely doing a lot more of her other muscles and doing very little at her pelvic floor. One of the most effective cues personally that I find is for women to imagine that there is a zip from their back passage going right up to their front passage. And if they think of closing that zip up, so they're not allowed to clench the bum cheeks, but they have to close a zip from back passage to front passage and open it, because relaxing your pelvic floor is just as important as strengthening it. I tend to find that that relates to them. You can, it's not recommended that you do your pelvic floor exercises while you're passing urine. You shouldn't stop and start the flow. They used to be taught like that many years ago. It's okay to try it just to get the brain connected to see, aha, okay, so that's how I'd stop the flow of urine, or that's how I'd slow down the flow of urine. Because some women might try it and they're not able to actually seal off the flow of urine because their strength just is not good enough. But it can be a good idea to check it and then go, right, so if I wasn't passing urine and I was trying to do that action, this is what I do. If you have tried, if anyone's sitting there and has tried what I've described and you're still like, I have no idea what she is talking about, it is worth accessing a pelvic health physio. You don't have to have symptoms, and you can just be in wanting to ensure that you're doing them right so that you can prevent any issues. And we're not as scary as people might think. It's nobody likes to go and get their pelvic floor out or examined, but usually when women have a pelvic floor examination, they're so relieved and so informed, and they actually feel, I'm so glad I did that, because now I know I wasn't doing it right. I didn't have a clue what people were talking about when they talked about things to do with pelvic health or prolapse. Because even just having a bit of education about what the different pelvic organs are, and I use real-time ultrasound in my clinic, so I can use it against the perineum, and women get a view of their bladder and the rectum, and sometimes even having that mind-body connection or being able to visualize it makes so much sense to women. Because I always tell my patients, it's really funny, because when I used to work in MSK, you could demonstrate an exercise like a biceps curl or some sort of normal exercise that people can see, and the patient is right in front of you, and when they go to repeat it back, they still don't do it right. So if women are not getting an exercise that they can see you demonstrate in front of them correctly, how do we expect them to get an exercise that is just written on a sheet, or that someone's just give them one simple cue to do? So yes, hopefully people have a little bit more idea of what the pelvic floor is after Emma's description and some of those cues that I give.
Amazing, that's so useful.
Are you doing them now?
Yeah. I've definitely tried.
Like, all of what you're saying is just so interesting, and I'm sure all of the people listening will be really, really interested. Are there any specific resources? Like, obviously there's your Return to Exercise guidelines, but like, where can they be found, and also any other resources that you might have been working on?
Yeah, and the Return to Running guidelines are available. Usually if you Google them, you'll find them, but they're on my website and Emma's, and they're on our links in our link trees and Instagram. I'm Absolute Physio on Instagram, and Emma is Physio Mum UK. But there's lots of resources, even like the NHS Squeezy app. Now, it's not completely free, but it's a nominal fee to cover its costs. And it's a really good app to remind you to do pelvic floor exercises, and to also guide you on how to do them. So it'll just give you some information. It will give you bladder training and bladder hygiene information as well. And what I like about it is, for, it's really important, we never discussed this earlier, but with pelvic floor training, you don't just do 10 quick squeezes and that's you done. You have to train both your fast twitch muscle fibers and your slow twitch muscle fibers. And for anyone who is like, what is she talking about? Really important to train both, because if I go to cough or sneeze, or if I miss a step when I'm out walking, it's my fast twitch fibers that will act in to support my bladder and maintain my bladder control. Whereas if I'm out and about and I get an urge to go to the toilet and there's no toilet anywhere near, it's my slow twitch and endurance fibers which will act in to control. So we need to train both, and actually the pelvic floor is predominantly made of slow twitch fibers. So when we're doing our pelvic floor exercises, yes, ideally you need to be able to do your quick reps. So you do the close the zip in and out as fast as you can, ideally getting up to about 8 to 10 reps. And you also need to do your slow holds, aiming to hold for 10 seconds without holding your breath, and to repeat that 8 to 10 times. Women tend to count 10 seconds very quickly when they're doing them themselves. So I like about the Squeezy app is that it has a wee timer that counts them, and it seems so much longer when you do them that way, but it's a lot more accurate. Other resources that are out there, I've had this ebook as well for anyone who has abdominal separation, or if anyone wants to find out more. about it. So abdominal separation is something that can be quite common in pregnancy, just because our abdominal muscles get stretched and elongated as a natural occurring process of pregnancy. And to decrease fear out there about diastasis or abdominal separation, some degree of separation is completely normal and expected towards the end of pregnancy. The thing is, it normally resolves naturally in about 2/3 of women, and for reasons unbeknown, it exists in, it's ongoing in about 1/3 of women. So they're the women that we want to make sure know about it and know how to get help, because there's a lot that you can do to help it, and it's really important to strengthen up again afterwards.
The only other resource that I can think off the top of my head that I'd recommend is the Squeezy Pelvic Health Directory. So you can get referred to a pelvic health physiotherapist via your NHS physio, GP, sorry. And in some cases you can self-refer as well. But if you want to look down more the private route, the Squeezy Directory has a list, not of everyone, but of all the pelvic health physios that have added their names to the directory. So that's also a good resource if you're just trying to look for some treatment as well.
Yeah, that's amazing, and I think that's really, really important. We'll try and provide links to all of the apps and resources and both of your specific Instagram pages, etc., in the show notes. But I think that is a really good point, because I'm imagining myself in the shoes of one of the practitioners I might work with, and if, as I said, like discussing this topic is going to be pretty taboo, but then knowing what to do about it is even more so. So I think that is so useful. So thank you for highlighting that as well. I just wanted to bring it back briefly to, so in reality, okay, I'm just thinking again of like trying to help my sister, who's a recreational runner who, let's just say she's now, well, I think she's 18 months postpartum, so that's a long time ago, but say she was 18 days postpartum, and she was saying to me, like, what do I do? Like, the doctor said that I'm fine and the midwife thinks I'm healing and recovering really well. Like, how do I know when to exercise? And I think we actually did a research study last year looking at pregnancy and the pre and postpartum window specifically, and looking at the advice that women were given across 7 different countries. And we really seem to highlight that in the UK there seems to be in particular a lack of guidance out there. Like, what would you suggest to, as to not necessarily how to improve that, but what would you suggest to, for me to tell my sister, or for any woman out there in that kind of situation?
Yeah, I think we're making changes there. So the Chief Medical Officer has some physical activity guidelines out there now for postnatal women, which basically recommends that postnatal women are exercising from day zero, sensibly, 150 minutes of physical activity every week. So I guess broken down 30 minutes over 5 days. And doing that in a graded approach. So we worked with that team of researchers and developed an infographic which basically gives you a weekly breakdown over those first 12 weeks of the exercises that you can consider whilst perhaps you're waiting to return to higher impact exercise and more competitive sport. And again, that can be accessed via our link trees again, I think, and it's in the BGSM journal, and basically that gives you a really nice breakdown of the lower impact exercises that you can look to return to. So the most important message that we should get across is that we should be encouraging women postnatally to exercise, but it's doing the exercises, the right exercise at the right time, which not only protects their musculoskeletal and their pelvic health, but also obviously is happening so that it protects their mental health as well, because obviously we know to exercise encourages better or promotes better mental health. So hopefully those two resources are there to guide women. So are there any other resources, Gonya, or any other?
Just probably what's on the Active Pregnancy Foundation as well, and even get, like, for say for the likes of your sister, just some common sense sort of tips that can be quite good. Obviously, if there is any symptoms being experienced, whether that's pelvic health symptoms or musculoskeletal symptoms, it's an indication to think about it the same way as you'd think about any other injury. So if you were getting a nagging, like your calf was giving you bother, your Achilles heel was giving you bother, you'd have to do something about it. So either scale back, try to access help to rehab whatever area is giving bother, and then do a graded approach back. So like when we're getting women back to say running, it's usually advised to do a couch to 5K approach. So for that, like we're on walk program that then eventually builds up. If people are okay for some parts of a run, but it's only towards the end that they overdo it and they get symptoms, it can be sensible to consider the terrain that you're running on. So softer terrain is going to be easier on joints. It's also easier on pelvic floor impact. And even things like, a lot of women don't realize that actually uphill running is more favorable in terms of lowering their impact through their lower limb and their pelvic floor. So actually uphill running, walk down, uphill running, walk down can be a nice way to work out, that you still feel like you're getting that workout. You still feel like you're getting back to running and getting that identity back. You're still keeping muscles conditioned, but you're not maybe flaring up the symptoms that you were getting if you were to run on the flat or if you were to run downhill, because that tends to be quite a lot of impact. I think that keeping women as close to the activity they want to get to as possible is best, because if we tell women to scale back from running completely, they are going to decondition. So they're going to find, they're keep, you're in that cycle of how do they eventually get back. So you need to keep them active. Some of the other low alternative, lower impact alternatives are the likes of the Stairmaster, or even a treadmill with an incline can be a really nice way to do a run if you have access to a treadmill.
Well, thank you so much for all that information. It's just amazing to see what you've both achieved over the, you know, the past so many years, and the information that is now out there. I know, sort of like as a female athlete myself, I definitely feel a lot better about, you know, making that move whenever that move might be, because I feel the support is able to be accessed. I think it's just about spreading the message perhaps to the non-elite athletes and the people who might not have done physical activity before or want to take it up and just want to be more aware of that kind of pelvic health information.
Thank you so much, both of you. Like, that was amazing and just so informative, and yeah, I think it's going to be so useful to our listeners, so really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for all that you're doing to raise these topics and to inform people. It's amazing.
That was super interesting, really, hearing from two sort of practitioners in the field of pregnancy. And I think we can all say we were all practicing our pelvic floors as we were listening to them chime on about everything that they've been doing. And yeah, two really inspirational ladies, and they've obviously seen like the gaps firsthand with their patients in the hospitals or just day-to-day practice, and they've addressed it, and they've addressed it for the wider population, which I think as a researcher, that's really sort of inspirational and what we all strive to do.
It's a massive take-home for me even to think, I really need to work on my pelvic floor. And I think even though this episode obviously is all about pregnancy, I also think there's so many actions for women in general.
Yeah, and actually there was a recent article I read a couple of years ago, might have been a year ago, where urinary incontinence is actually a lot more common than you might think.
Yeah, I definitely see that a fair amount, to be honest. And I feel like that can be significantly decreased, or incidence can be decreased, if we actually have more of an understanding about this.
Great, so for question time this week.
So I've actually had a question, and I've had a few relatively similar questions, which I think are particularly interesting. So around phase four of the menstrual cycle, so in that pre-menstrual window, I guess quite a few people have reached out to highlight that they feel a bit more anxious at that time and sort of are more prone to overthinking and feeling almost more insecure. Now, interestingly, and I guess their key question is that normal and what can they do about it? Now, this is definitely something which I have seen through the athletes I work with, and also we saw in our research that we've done over this period of time. So Jess and I, and actually Lucy, have all done research during COVID. And this is something which we've seen more of. And I think obviously given the crazy world that we're living in at the moment, where anxiety levels are already elevated, adding in that premenstrual stress, which people talk about, but effectively where your hormones suddenly decline. And since, as I always say, your hormones travel around your whole body, so they are going to your brain as well, but suddenly taking them away can really affect your neurobiology. It can affect your hormonal release of other hormones as well, including hormones which help to control emotion and which help to keep you feeling happy and positive. And the sudden withdrawal of those hormones can really create a bit of a perfect storm when you add in existing stresses around managing everything around the coronavirus. So first thing I would say is that's not abnormal. So don't beat yourself up about feeling like that. But also, I think stepping back and thinking about how can you factor in like me time that isn't going to add to that stress. So doing something like yoga or Pilates or going for a walk, getting some Headspace, even using Headspace or another similar app. Some people like to meditate or listen to podcasts. I'd say just getting that kind of mental refresh, reset time is so important, and effectively remembering that you need to look after me as well. The other thing I would say is just from a nutritional perspective, again, we know that premenstrual phase is this pro-inflammatory phase, but we also know that there's a number of foods which can kind of promote your body to recover. They can look after your brain, but also they can increase the release of the hormone serotonin, which is what we would call the happiness hormone. So slightly manipulating your diet can also be a really good actionable thing that you can do. Foods which are specifically shown or demonstrated to increase serotonin levels, so like the happiness hormones, would be things like nuts and seeds, eggs, oily fish like salmon, some white meats as well, like turkey. And I guess like a biggest take home on that would be actually not having big gaps between meals either, because where your blood sugar levels drop, that's where you can start to feel more kind of irritable and full of anxiety. So I think like having small regular meals, including complex carbohydrates, which we know can increase the, like, I guess like a sense of satiety and a sense of happiness, alongside some protein would be really beneficial.
Good answer. I would say if people get put off doing actual meditation, there's really great mindful activities that you can do, like might be stating the obvious here, but I might as well say it. So like jigsaws, mindful colouring books and paint by numbers. And I also got this thing the other day, which you like put together water beads and they tell you which order to put them in. So they look like animals and then you spray them with water and they come out as animals. I did that the other day. I really enjoy doing that. So.
Well, that's all for this episode. We really hope you enjoyed our chat with Gronja and Emma, two women who are very much on the same mission as our own, to empower through education and raising awareness. We've of course included all the relevant links in the show notes. This week, we'd like to thank Hannah Welling for becoming a patron of our podcast. Becoming a patron costs just £3.29 a month and supports our mission of empowering more women to own and understand their bodies and open up important topics which often go under-researched and under-discussed. We'd like to thank our sponsor for this series, Pretty Athletic. Head to www.prettyathletic.com to view the amazing range of products available and use discount code FEMALEATHLETEPOD for 20% off. Thanks for listening.